Arquitetura entre vistas. Your public space for thinking architecture is now going abroad. Welcome, I'm Catarina, no longer a student, not yet an architect. Join me and a guest architect 3 times a month, with new episodes dropping every 3rd, 13th and 23rd. 3 is the number to remember. Each episode on a different place, but always on Spotify. And Instagram and on the website arquitecturaentrevistas.com. Go check it out. Just before we start, a few words from our sponsors.
Bellon. Bellon is your go-to Portuguese brand for office furniture. Bellon design is inspired by the color of wooden houses in Aveiro and the iconic steel bridges of Porto.
Now, let's talk architecture.
Today, I welcome Benedetto Rogers and Daniel Marmot. They are the duo behind Artifact, a young architectural studio based in London and founded in 2021. Its project is a project of caring, caring about the identity of the client, caring about the atmosphere of the site, caring about the details of how things are made and how things relate. In other words, they care the most about building as a cultural object. This statement piques my curiosity and I would like to discuss them further. Benedetta and Daniel, what is exactly a cultural object? How do I identify a cultural object? And how can this be applied to architecture?
Tough question. I think any building is a cultural object in some way or other, in that buildings are products of a time, an age, an economic situation, a political situation. And there are all sorts of kind of cultural influences that go into the creation of everyday building. So I think one of the reasons why the practice is called Artifact is we're interested in buildings not as kind of mute or inert objects, but something that can tell us a bit more about the wider society, the people that commission them, the clients that live in them, the communities that occupy them. So I guess we like the idea that the buildings that we are designing and we'll go on to design say something about a wider culture rather than just being these kind of inert objects in the city.
So your idea is to find the cultural objects in the city and then with your projects also deliver to the city new cultural objects.
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, it's partly about where we take our inspiration from as well. So there might be the individual culture of a client, a family that live in a place that we use to kind of help take our inspiration from. So I guess it's partly about maybe an approach to, you know, how we design. A lot of our projects at the moment are not necessarily at the city scale, a lot of our experiences, but as a practice, because we knew we're operating a much smaller scale. So it's maybe about the, you know, the day-to-day influences and cultures of people who commission our buildings and projects that, you know, we take as a starting point.
And how do you ensure that your designs reflect the culture of your clients?
I guess through lots of conversation and testing ideas. And also we've had quite a kind of mixed range of clients from different backgrounds, which we often try and kind of weave into the way that we design. So whether or not it's a house designed around a traditional piece of Indian furniture that is in the center of one of our projects, or a project we're recently completing, which takes some of its inspiration from a book called Caribbean Style, which is all about the kind of vernacular Caribbean building. And there's kind of the use of color, some of the spaces and atmospheres in that book were really important to the way that we approach the design of the project. Or another project recently completed for a Jewish family where there's a new garden designed around Friday night dinners as part of the ritual. So I think there's typically a way in, you know, how people live that helps in terms of how we think about, I guess, like the character and atmosphere of a space, but also the spatial planning, how we might approach the initial design work.
And it might just be as simple as like the materials you choose. One of the houses we designed is quite dark terracotta colored walls that doesn't feel very English at all in some ways. And it was part of the culture of the client and their mixed heritage that brought that sort of completely different atmosphere, even just by the choice of the color of the bricks, basically. So it can be quite simple things, but taking inspiration from the client's background or the context, or a context they're interested in or they bring to the table, basically.
In a way, it is almost about finding the foreign references in the local projects you're working on. Almost finding the odd things, out of place things.
Yeah, I think particularly because we're working at quite a small scale on predominantly residential stuff, although starting to work on more community projects as well. There's a lot, particularly in London, there are thousands and thousands of house extensions, which I think increasingly feel very, very similar in tone. At any given time, there's a kind of prevailing aesthetic and approach for a certain kind of house extension. So I think we're normally looking for something to latch onto. Might be the character of the site or the neighborhood. Might be just something that crops up in a conversation with the client. But we're looking for something that we can kind of almost harness to hopefully create something that feels a little bit unusual. So I think that's always something we're looking for. And maybe that's where our work doesn't feel particularly English. I hope that's true. As you were saying when we were just starting this conversation, I guess there's so much exposure to stuff from all around the world, and a lot of the most exciting stuff, or nearly all the most exciting stuff happening, is not happening in the UK architecture scene. So I think we probably do take our references from as far afield as we can, which will hopefully mean that our work doesn't feel directly a product of the time and the place, but a little bit unusual in the context.
There is this very interesting thing in this topic, because while some architecture studios think about huge airports, Olympic stadiums, and so on, other studios are thinking about the small scale of the house and rather think about the details and the craft architecture. What is culture after all? Is culture about differences or about the similarities?
So I think there are lots of different scales of culture that you would encounter. I guess particularly as an architect, if you're designing an airport, I guess you're thinking about national or local, national or even international identity. Whereas at a very small scale, you're thinking about the culture of individuals. So I think they're very different challenges in a way. I mean, from our point of view, we're interested in the personal and kind of social culture, but also the material culture of our projects. I think they're two slightly different sides to our work and the way that we think about what we do. And hopefully they start to come together in certain ways, in certain projects. And we'll see how that pans out over the course of, current projects that are on site and, future ones on the drawing board.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you have this premeditated, almost as if you have a language of your own studio? Or are you still figuring out what is your way of doing?
Oh, we're definitely still figuring it out. It's like, it's an iterative process, and I think it takes a long time. But your first question brought in also the subject of how we build. It wasn't just about culture, wasn't it? It was also about how we build in like maybe a more sustainable world, like more smaller scale. That's definitely something that we want to develop more as time goes on.
Yeah,
but I guess we have... You go, Dan.
I guess in my mind, I think neither of us are clear whether or not we'd even want to have a coherent style, like a house style. I think it's too early to really say, whether or not we'll end up with increasingly similar projects or whether or not we'll seek to make each one different, as we go forward. I think we're probably not striving for a really coherent body of work, actually. But I don't know what you think, but maybe we'll move towards that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because every project is different. You'd have to start working together. We're bringing our own influences together. Other people will be, hopefully the office would grow and there'll be other people who will bring their own influences. So I think it should always be something in sort of process. There is a methodology and there is interests and a way we look at the world that is sort of will be consistent, but the projects will always be evolving, I think.
Yes, and in a way, the circumstances are always different. Also, the client is always different. The place is always different. You are different every time you start a project. And in this increasingly speed of the world, maybe yesterday's project is already not enough for a project to start tomorrow, So we have to reinvent ourselves every time.
And the speed of architecture is actually quite slow. So you design something and then once you've built it, you're already but I'm already thinking of more sustainable materials. I'm thinking of, so it's true within even the lifespan of a project, one can always feel I would have done it all different today. Yeah, it's definitely always on the move.
It is almost never enough, never too sustainable, we never have enough time, we never have enough anything. We're always late, always There is always something to be done.
I guess, yeah, but also we're constantly getting more inspiration that we'll be like, ah, oh, you know, we could have incorporated this. Like, it's growing, isn't it, as we go?
Yeah, I feel like guys, architecture is an imperfect, you know, the process of making a building is imperfect in so many ways. You know, there'll never be the perfect project where I guess you're happy with every element. It all comes together exactly as you imagined it. There's all sorts of contingencies and things that can kick in along the way that change the outcome. And I find often that you get to the end of a project and you might, all of those things are really at the forefront of your mind because you've had issues with the construction, the contractor sometimes that you've had to resolve. And then you take a step back and you look back and think, actually, a lot of the issues fade into the background and you're left with the thing at the end of it that often you become almost more fond of over time. As we move through time, I think we'll probably know a bit more about actually how we work and what we're about. I think it's too early for us to, you know, have a really coherent idea about that. I think we can maybe look back in a few years and find out what happened.
I can definitely feel the love for the materials you have. And I might ask, what do you think about new materials? Are these new materials much more adapted to our needs of today? Or do you feel like the everyday materials are those that still respond the best to our needs?
Actually, I think the a lot of the new materials are actually kind of old materials. The future of materials is not necessarily, you know, thinking about what technology can produce, but a lot of it might just be thinking about how we can build sensitively and nicely out of the stuff that's been around for a long time. So I think predominantly we're probably not interested in new materials necessarily, but maybe new ways of using existing materials in interesting ways.
I like this idea of instead of new materials, it is more about new ways of using these same old materials. This also reminds me of almost those desserts at fancy restaurants in which they are named hazelnut three ways or chocolate triology, something like that, you know? So can you give me examples of some usages of these conventional materials that you figured out a way to use it unconventionally?
Yes.
You are now trying to remember all your projects in your mind.
In a house that's not yet built, it's called Ash Tree House. So it's this house around this kind of really enormous, mature, beautiful ash tree. We tried to use lots of bio-based materials. One of the things was using earth bags as a retaining wall. So essentially you fill the bags with soil from the site, you can retain the earth, you know, without using lots of concrete, and then you make holes in them, you put plants in them, and then over time, hopefully it will grow into a really nice green wall. So I think that's an example of really basic technology, and it uses material on the site, but it will also create the character of this, you know, facade of the building. Yeah, know what that's going to look like. We hope it will look nice. The plants will grow well and become a key part of the project. I guess that's an example of having a sense of what something will feel like maybe a few years after the project's completed even.
Yes, this is the most fascinating part about architecture, that we're not sure how this is going to come out, but we're going to do it anyway. My question is, how does a client respond to this kind of statement?
Can I say we don't really tell them? We don't know what it's going to look like. With architecture, you never know what it's going to look like. You know, it's only when you're on site and it's built. It's always a bit of a risk for us and the clients, and there's always that quite exciting moment where it goes up and everyone's like, oh, it was working really well. But I guess trying to like encourage clients to do a bit more unusual things and things that are like less off the shelf. It's really just about convincing them of the general benefits of it. In this case, it makes sense to have earth bags instead of loads of concrete. Well, quite a few people are now on board with the sustainable importance of taking these decisions. And actually showing that it could have effect, you know, you gain twice, don't you?
The happy part is that it almost always comes out well. Was there ever a big risk you took and didn't go as well as planned?
Not yet, fingers crossed.
Not yet.
And when it does come, we'll start making very basic risk-free buildings with that. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if there is any other possibility for architecture other than it being a craft?
I mean, obviously, we're very much engaged in the craft of making, but I don't know. There's, you know, it's quite a broad question.
I mean, I feel like there's not that much craft in a lot of architecture. You know, a lot of the way that we build is increasingly mechanized. Lots of stuff's made off-site. there are increasingly common ways of making most buildings without much variation. So it feels to me as if most of the kind of craft or the attention to detail and materials and junctions and how things come together typically happens at a really small scale. But actually, in the majority of building, I'm not sure you'd necessarily call it a craft. It's probably there's a different technical skill set that goes into making those big complex buildings. But I'm not sure craft is necessarily the way that I describe most building.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely true in the UK that most of the interesting stuff does happen at a kind of small scale, a micro scale almost. Meanwhile, tower blocks are popping up all over the place, which are kind of, you know, stacked floor plans and facades that you've seen 100 times before, but, you know, where you know exactly what you're going to get. There's lots of building where the architecture is kind of besides the point, I think. And it's only in kind of little corners or pockets of the industry where I think a lot of the love and attention goes into.
And how do you balance your commitment to detail with the increased scale of construction industry and mass production?
Most of our projects are reasonably small scale at the moment, so there's not really we haven't tested it out yet. So I guess we'll see.
Would you like to have that opportunity, or do you like to work in the scale you're in right now?
I think we'd like to have a bit more variation. We're doing a lot of domestic work, which we really enjoy, but we also have like one community project which we're particularly enjoying. So there's benefits. So I think, like Dan said, there's benefits on staying at a small scale because you're very close to it and you can really craft the projects. But I feel like working on like different scales is also really good, and it feeds one into the other. We actually both had early experience of working for urban design practice, working at the city level actually. And that's, although we're not working at that level, that has like influenced a lot of our work at the same time. So I think there's a sense that working at different scales can always inform the other scales too. So yeah, definitely we'd like to work on different scales.
I feel like my experience to date has been like, you know, the Eames film, The Power of 10, where you start really zoomed out at the kind of city scale, and then you gradually zoom in to the scale of an urban block and a master plan to the scale of a kind of big building. And we've kind of zoomed in and in to the point where we're like now doing really kind of quite bespoke stuff. I've really enjoyed that. And I think it'd be interesting to start zooming back out a bit to see how that will influence what happens going forward.
I wonder, for example, if these industrial logics of construction and mass production, aren't these almost cultural objects as well, part of the cultural language of today? And if so, should we bring that to the smaller scale of architecture, or are they part of a different kind of dialogue?
I think a lot of the large-scale industrial processes relating to bigger buildings require a building of a certain scale to make them. So, for example, cross-laminated timber, in my mind, makes a lot more sense if you're working at a big or a medium-scale building. A smaller scale, maybe not so much, but where you could actually use other types of timber section and construct the thing perfectly well. If you're working on big buildings, then, you know, the industrial processes around the construction of them is absolutely essential to how you make that building. How you can be creative within that framework is, I think, essential, particularly as you're working on bigger buildings. Probably at the scale we're working at, there's not mass production or industrialization. I mean, there is in the supply chains. There aren't typically enough elements to repeat to require a kind of mass industrial operation to get the things made.
Yeah.
But I think the supply chain is like a really key thing. You know, a lot of like the architecture that was produced today is very much dependent on specific supply chains. And actually, we need to work within the supply chains that exist. And so when we transition to something more sustainable, for example, those supply chains don't exist. And so I think more than industrialized processes, it's the supply chains that are a real challenge to work with sometimes if you're trying to do something different or to change things at a small scale.
So you care about where you find your products, where the products come from?
Where they come from, how they come from, and like how available they are. On a lot of these small projects, you need to have something very, very available, or like how trained your workforces to actually install those products. You know, a lot of these new bio-based materials, it might be harder to find contractors that are happy to actually install them. That culture of how we build is quite an interesting thing, and how that has to shift in years to come, and how you have to work within it, and how you try to work, I guess, at the boundaries of it to change it.
Mm-hmm. Constraints are everywhere, basically. Imagine if you're working on a big scale, sometimes the challenge is about finding enough material that you can use for that project. And also, I think this language of constraints happens in one of your projects. There is this tiny door, almost children-sized. And if I'm right, this opening from the kids' room to the main room had to be implemented to the project just to satisfy the building control requirements. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Gulabi House.
In what stage of the project were you when you realized that you had to have a passage from one bedroom to the other? Were you aware of it from the beginning, or were you already in the construction side when you found out about that?
In the case of that project, it was post-planning after it had permission. But I think when we're doing the construction drawings, the building control got involved, and it was a bit of a grey area. So in our regulations, essentially, you can jump out of a first floor window if there's a fire to escape, but you can't jump out of a second floor window. In this case, a two-story house with an extension on one side, and the question mark was over the there was on the side extension, there was a skylight, which building control decided you couldn't get around. So it was reasonably late in the day. So we had the option of either a much more expensive, toughened skylight, smaller in scale, or a creative solution to a regulation issue. So what we ended up with this tiny little door is the minimum sized opening that you can have to crawl from one side of the house to the other to then jump out of the first floor window and escape onto the street in the event of fire. So it's kind of a playful approach to the constraints, and the size of it is exactly the size of the building control, the regulation requirement.
If you could, would you take out that tiny door of the project?
Hell no. No, it's one of the nicest things in it, I think.
I agree.
So I think taking constraints and kind of working with them creatively, I think, is probably one of the key things we've tried to do in our work today. Partly because we've worked on typically pretty low budget projects for relative to what the client wants to achieve on the project. So, for example, we've got another project, not yet photographed, but that finished recently, which is a kind of enfilade of all kind of open spaces, all with exposed blockwork walls, kind of passageways and doorways that flow into each other. Mm-hmm. So we designed that whole thing as a kind of series of rooms that are interconnected. So they kind of feel, you know, part enclosed, but part open. One of the reasons for designing it that way is just to reduce the cost of essentially building extra area where the corridor is wasted space, but also just every time you put an internal door in, have to line it and do the reveals and all of that, it's extra cost. It's a spatial idea that emerges in part from a constraint. So I think we're typically trying to find creative responses to often kind of difficult challenges.
Yeah, the gray areas are always worth exploring, maybe. This is amazing because the inputs of the clients are probably something like, we want a 3 or so family house with a lot of storage and probably a modest budget, as you said. But on the other side, what comes out of these inputs is something that is much more joyful and almost as if the client gives the rules, but then you play with these rules just as if it was a game. How do you identify the things you can play around with? How do you find this play area, let's call it?
Sometimes the client comes to you with a very like specific level. This is what we want. And we find often like we test it and then we come back to them with something different that is not necessarily what they asked for. But it's a variation of what they asked for. You try to really understand how they live and, you know, what they're interested in, and like, you know, you take input from them, but then you play around with it, you be creative, basically, and give them something unexpected that they didn't really know they wanted. And I think that's the best, when your client's like, oh my God, I never thought about that. That's so nice. That sounds really good. You know, when you get that moment of they've given you input, but you've taken it and completely turned it around and given it back to them in another form, and they're happy about it, you know, that's the best, right? Propose something they never thought about within the parameters of their rules. Don't know if that answers it.
Yeah, definitely. And why do you think that the clients are always so certain about what they want? Is it because they probably don't know about the wider possibilities architecture can bring to everyone's life, let's say?
I mean, obviously, often they have a lot of practicalities in their mind. So it comes from a very like practical place. It comes from being very practical, but also like, you know, it's not their job to know how to design buildings. That's why they come to us. So it's a combination of those two, I think.
It's also part of the architect to be a little generous.
That's a nice way of putting it.
A book.
One book. Just one book.
There's a book, Architecture Without Architects. It's a Rudolfsky book from way back in the day that I remember first stumbling across in the library when I was, I think, in my first or second year. When I visited some of those kind of historic structures, towns, villages, I often find them more inspiring than visiting any sort of building. So I think it'd be quite, I think that book's always stuck with me.
I'm not going to be very good at these quick questions.
This was supposed to be fun, Benedetta.
Okay, I'm going to say the Floating Images book. It's actually Portuguese. It's called Floating Images, isn't it? It's Eduardo Souto de Moura.
Oh, okay. Yes, I know.
It's like an atlas of images and inspirations, but it's like quite random, but also quite precise in the way like the things are connected but not connected. It's like a very visual book.
I have it upstairs. I wasn't understanding the title because in Portuguese it's called Atlas de Parede.
Eduardo Souto de Moura's Wall Atlas, yeah. I like that.
A place.
Place. I'd say in the west of England, there's a track called the Ridgeway, which is this kind of high-level track that goes past all of these amazing Neolithic sites. There's kind of white horses and made out of chalk on cliffs and old stone circles. So I'd say going for a walk along there. No buildings, though, on that walk. It's all that pure nature. Or at least the buildings there are 5,000 years old.
Architecture without architects, as you were saying, right?
A landscape without architecture or architects.
I'm going to go equally like outdoorsy. I'm just going to say the Alps. I'm part Italian, so I come from Northern Italy. So, you know, I'm just going to give all the Alps as a place.
An architect.
I feel like as a practice, we don't really have any sort of like key architect touchstones. Maybe we need some, but I'd say probably Louis Kahn just visited his Indian Institute of Management in Ahmedabad. And it was a really kind of magical, soulful experience.
I mean, again, this is difficult. Like, it always changes. Like, but I think lately I'm always looking at from Belgium, Marie-Josée Vanhy. I really like her work. Yeah, Marie-Josée Vanhy. I like her.
A project of your own.
They're all good. I think I'm gonna. When I was working in practice, I worked on a really nice project called the People Place while I was working at Featherston Young Architects. It was, we put an art gallery into a car park, an old market square, and it was a really nice mix of uses and people coming together. And it just felt like we had a little bit of a city in a building, and I really liked that. So, yeah, I'd say that one.
For me, I think, probably something in practice, still not built, that I worked on many years ago, hopefully will still get built, which is it's a kind of social housing estate regeneration master plan, where one phase of it is built, and the next phase was a big collaboration with kind of lots of buildings, but really comprehensive refurbishment of all lots of existing post-war housing flats to give everybody new outdoor space, new community space, newly landscaped gardens, new play facilities, kind of whole chunk of city with affordable workspace and housing. And there was kind of, it's a big master plan with lots of, you know, lots of housing, but it had lots of ideas at different scales within it. And if it does come to pass, which hopefully it will one day, I think it will be a really nice kind of little piece of city.
Thank you, Benedetta and Daniel. I wonder what, once in the future, we, humans, will consider to be the artifacts of today. Thank you for raising this question.
Nice to meet you. Bye. Good luck with the project.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. Did you know you can also take part in this episode? Go to arquitecturaentrevistas.com and upload images of projects that came to your mind while listening to this episode. For each episode, you will find a cloud of references uploaded by listeners all over the world. Of course, you can check on this collection anytime for your own projects as well. Hit the follow button for more thoughts on architecture and catch daily updates on Instagram. Obrigada!